This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 24th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 235. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the Is It Just Me commentary, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and the big deal feature. So you think John Horgan and the BC NDP banned Cash for Access? Well, big money fundraisers are no more, but party friends and insiders are now benefiting from loopholes in the lucrative world of lobbying. My guest is Daniel Gold, author of Lobbying Regulation in Canada and the United States, Political Influence, Democratic Norms, and Charter Rights. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or is NDP Forests Minister Katrine Conroy right to refuse a meeting with an Extinction Rebellion splinter group? I say she is. Two of the members of Save Old Growth say that they're hunger-striking until they meet Conroy. They demand an immediate end to old-growth logging. BC does need a civilized conversation about forestry and the environment, but the NDP will not ban old-growth logging, especially when some First Nations want to cut some trees on their own land. One of the hunger-strikers is Howard Breen, who is well-known to police for arrests in 2019. He trespassed at John Horgan's Langford house and scared the Premier's wife. He also tried to, quote-unquote, citizens arrest Trudeau Liberal Environment Minister Catherine McKenna during an Oak Bay news conference that year. Clearly, Minister Conroy is making the right decision for her own safety. She's the same minister who suffered a concussion and other injuries after allegedly being knocked over on a sidewalk near the legislature in December. Breen's followers have targeted innocent working people, public transit users, and ambulance drivers and patients with illegal highway roadblocks in recent months. The only other thing that Conroy could have done differently would be to set a meeting with these protesters for September on the condition that they sign a legally binding contract to block no roads, no highways, and no bridges for the rest of spring and all of summer. She could also remind them that Canada prides itself on the rule of law, not the rule of mobs. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The BC NDP government ended the wild west of political campaign financing after it came to power in 2017. But it left the door wide open to lobbying by party friends and insiders, a different kind of cash for access. In the Breaker.News, I revealed how former NDP party president Craig Keating has joined Strategies 360 as a vice president. He registered to lobby for the marijuana company Tantalus Labs. I also revealed that the NDP operative who headed BC government health communications for almost a year, Jeffrey Ferrier, is now at Hill & Knowlton. He registered to lobby the NDP government for vaccine maker AstraZeneca. Joining me on the podcast is my guest Daniel Gold, Doctor of Constitutional Law and Public Policy from the University of Ottawa, and author of the 2020 thesis, Lobbying Regulation in Canada and the United States, Political Influence, Democratic Norms, and Charter Rights. It's a must-read for anyone curious about the inner workings of government. I started by asking Daniel Gold about the bold statement early in his thesis that lobbying is corrosive to democracy.
You say that lobbying is corrosive to democracy. Can you expand on that?
Certainly. Lobbying is a really... ironically, a core tenet of democracy, yet also corrosive to democracy. If you think about it, as citizens, we have two ways of interacting with our government. We vote, you know, generally once every 4 years for a particular level of government. And the other thing we do is we can lobby them, in theory. In theory, we can bring up our concerns. Now, the reality is that lobby has become the domain of corporations. To some extent, unions, but that's a pretty old story. If you look... The United States, the trend is incredibly clear, but even in Canada, union participation has been declining immensely, and lobbying has become this domain where corporations get to interact directly with our government. discuss their concerns, raise their concerns, and frame the whole discussion exactly how they want it sort of covered. It's not to say that the government is necessarily trying to undermine democracy, but it's just a side effect of how this process has gone off the rails. Lobbying is seen as legitimate, yet at the same time, it's become a system where the corporations get a voice and the citizens have less and less of a voice. And if you think about the interactions, you know, we elect a government every 4 years, whereas a lobbyist might be into the same office once a month, sometimes once a week, raising their concerns and I'd say massaging the output of government.
When the NDP came to power, it banned cabinet members and deputy ministers from lobbying the government for 2 years after they leave the government. But the revolving door continues for many people who don't fall under the legal definition of former public office holder.
This has been a big improvement from where lobbying was completely unregulated to this sort of process of starting to have some oversight, and starting to have maybe some citizen input in the process. But it has also been pretty slow. And we've seen this sort of step where a lot of governments have, in North America, have put in sort of, I would say, a second draft of legislation. There was a first draft in the 2010s-ish, and now there's sort of a second draft, and it's improved things, but they've left, maybe deliberately, maybe accidentally, a lot of loopholes out. And the revolving door issue is maybe one of the biggest ones. I mean, first of all, I think there's a very strong argument that the revolving door stand should be a term of government. There's really no reason it should be half a term of government. It's a little odd, and I don't know why this has happened. But with the revolving door, it's tricky. I mean, what they are trying to do is they are trying to say, okay, we have certain government officials that have a lot of influence, and it's unfair if they lobby. But we also have a number of lower level officials or bureaucrats who really have no input in the day-to-day process of government. You know, they have to do what they have to do, and they don't get any say over policy or the direction of government. And we don't want to ban them from a future career in lobbying. So we try to come up with this designated office holder list. I don't think it's necessary, but it's the way that governments across North America have decided to do it. And when you do that, you're always going to have this issue that there's going to be people on the borderline. And wherever you put this border, some people are going to fall through. So it's better than not having it. It's a lot better than not having it, but some people are going to fall through. And there's always a question of, you know, were these deliberate loopholes that were left in because political pressure or because it was a hassle or someone just didn't want to make a change or these accidental oversights? And either way, you end up with the situations you've discussed where you have certain people who had a great deal of say and then a great deal of connections in government and then get hired for it and don't have to wait out that revolving door period of 2 years or a little more, which, you know, opens the system to more corruption and gives them an advantage as well. And really raises questions about how much our government is representing us versus how much it's going on to represent the people that are being lobbied for.
My guest, Daniel Gold, is an expert on lobbying. In his doctoral thesis, he examined how lobbying and political campaign donations are two sides of the same coin.
We've got, I think, two trends that have interacted. One trend is just there's been an increase in lobbying since the 70s. Basically, in the 70s, corporations started to figure out that lobbying was a very effective way of getting what they wanted out of government, be it tax cuts, certain regulations changed, exemptions, rules about maybe how they treat their employees or how they interact with the government around them, or, you know, whatever specific thing they wanted. And over the subsequent 50 years, it's become both more and more obvious to corporations that lobbying is a very effective way of getting high returns on their investments, in many ways more effective than campaign donations. And governments have also become more open to lobbying. So we have this trend building. And then the other thing that's happened is, as I discussed in my thesis, lobbying and campaign donations are two sides of the same coin. They're both ways of influencing political figures. And in many ways, they work together. So if you give a donation, then you get access to a politician. And once you have access to the politicians, you can raise your concern, and the politician feels indebted to you and is more likely to take your concern seriously. However, in Canada in particular, and to some extent in certain parts of the states, we've had a stricter set of regulations about campaign financing, and I'm glad that BC has finally started to catch up there. And this is pretty good. This has definitely been helpful. We've seen some declines in certain types of corruption. We see more openness to citizen voices and cleaner elections when we get these rules in. But from the corporate point of view, they have a certain amount of money they're gonna spend on politics, on getting their way. And sometimes this is a very good investment. It's actually more effective than investing in a new market or improving their product. You can get obscene returns from it, certain tax breaks and subsidies. And they have this pool of money. And since they can no longer spend some of it on campaign financing and some of it on lobbying, they just switch more and more of it to lobbying. So basically, they have two ways of influencing government. You can sort of buy, I put that in quotation marks, but buy your way in to seeing them through campaign donations. And then you can just try to convince them with lobbying. And they prefer to use both, but if they can't use both, they'll use whichever one's still available. And we've regulated campaign finance fairly strictly, which is great, but we've left the door wide open on lobbying with really minimal restrictions. So corporate money has moved that way.
I revisited the issue of the revolving door and the lack of statutory code of conduct for lobbyists in BC. The federal code of conduct clearly tells lobbyists in Ottawa that there's a conflict of interest if they're a former political party executive who is now lobbying someone that they helped get elected. That appears to be a big hole in the law, where you have someone who works or has worked to get people elected now knocking on their door on behalf of clients to try to get laws changed, to try to get contracts or try to get taxes changed.
I think it's absolutely a large hole in the law. This system... So the system that BC put in is modeled largely on the federal system. And the federal system for regulating lobbying has two sections, as you've discussed. There's the specific rules, which are somewhat laxed and mostly focused on at least some disclosure, not strong restrictions. But we do have specific rules. And then there is also a code of conduct. And this has evolved over the time, but it's become fairly comprehensive and fairly strict, and it essentially says that in various ways, if you have undue influence on a politician or an official, you should not lobby them. There are questions about how well this is enforced, but it has been considered legally binding, at least. And what BC seems to have done is taken kind of half the legislation, because when they put in the regulations we have without the code of conduct, they've left this very large loophole in the law. And, people will take advantage of it because it's illegal and it's lucrative. And if you can hire someone who has a lot of government connections and people who owe this person favors, you have a big leg up in lobbying, and it's worth doing. And if you're one of these people, the lobbying positions are incredibly lucrative. In the States it's even more so, but we can be talking salaries of multiple millions of dollars a year. And it's worth doing from both people's point of view. And technically, from our perspective, it's a form of corruption, but from their perspective, it's all legal. And that's a big problem. I mean, the code of conduct doesn't stop everything, but at least tells you there are boundaries and encourages people to stick within those boundaries. And BC's failure to enact a code of conduct or take that code of conduct and turn it into regulation in some other form has left this loophole, because political parties are private entities and they fall outside certain restrictions that former government officials might face, but they still have all that influence when their party members are in power. And we have to take account for that. And when we don't, we end up with situations like this where, they're walking in, they're lobbying, and I would assume they're pretty successful.
Finally, I asked Daniel Gold about trends in the influence industry. Mass media doesn't have the power it used to have, but now lobbying does in many ways.
Yeah, I think we've got a whole bunch of trends interacting, and this makes it, you know, complicated and difficult and I think disempowering for the average citizen. One of them is just the death of old media, and also the fragmentation of new media. So I wouldn't say necessarily that we're not seeing the use of public messaging, but I think it's changed enough that we almost don't recognize it. So I think we have this pattern where formal officials, people who still want money, power, or a lucrative career, they will go where the influence is. And the influence was in media, and the influence now is in lobbying and also in publicity campaigns. And I think we are actually, there is a fair amount of this still going on, but it's so targeted now that you almost don't recognize it, because it's all taking the form of micro-targeted political campaigns, not political campaigns, sorry, ad campaigns aimed at specific voters maybe, or aimed at a specific area or a specific demographic, or sometimes actually just aimed at a specific official or a specific government office. So, you know, it with the amount of data you can get online now, you can figure out where a person lives, where they work, and you can set up an ad campaign that just targets that person. And if that person is, say, the Minister of Health, you can set up an ad campaign advertising your drug and the benefits of your drug in such a way that pretty well just the Minister of Health sees it, which is kind of crazy, but become quite common. And a lot of lobbyists use this technique. So the influence, the combination of lobbying combined with sort of public pressure has changed. You're no longer trying to get all the public behind something unless it's a really big thing. Mostly you're just trying to get the key decision makers and maybe a few key supporters behind something. And you can do that without the public ever seeing what it is. You can do that just by specifically targeting that person. Maybe some lobbyists have discussed how they target that person and that person's friend group and maybe that person's business community, but no one else. They run these micro campaigns that are combined with their lobbying efforts. And from the official's point of view, it might look like everyone agrees with those lobbyists because they see the ads, they see their friends have seen the ads, and they don't realize that the rest of society has no idea that this conversation is going on and has not only no input, but just no clue. So, you know, our officials can be making decisions based on information that we've never seen that may or may not be true, and that's not vetted. And I mean, there's with the death of old media and the death of newspapers, I mean, not complete death, but decline, there's just fewer people who have the time to investigate this and really dig into the details. And some of this requires a lot of research to find out who's saying what to whom and how much money is being spent and what the outcomes are. And I mean, I recommend in my thesis, as you've seen, that we need actually some levels of government that not only oversee lobbying, but maybe set up a system to encourage lobbying for citizen groups just to balance the way things are turning. I mean, it's not ideal, but it's much better than what we're doing now.
That was my guest, Daniel Gould, Doctor of Constitutional Law and Public Policy from the University of Ottawa and author of the 2020 thesis, Lobbying Regulation in Canada and the United States, Political Influence, Democratic Norms, and Charter Rights. It's a must-read for anyone who's curious about the inner workings of government. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, Taiwanese news station mistakenly broadcast breaking news of Chinese invasion. News crawl displays message reading, New Taipei City hit by CCP missile. CTS issued a correction notice and public apology that during the 7 a.m. morning newscast on April 20th, due to a mistake on the part of relevant staff members, text from disaster drill messages provided by the fire department were mistakenly shown as news crawl content. CTS was commissioned by the fire department to record the disaster prevention video. Meanwhile, an official cited by Taiwanese media said it is highly likely that China will take a page from Putin's Ukraine war playbook and seize one of Taiwan's outer islands. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said Chairman Xi Jinping is under pressure ahead of the Communist Party's 20th National Congress. In the Hong Kong Free Press, Equality Watchdog defends stance on brownface after chairman claims not all cases discriminatory. Controversy surrounding a drama series on TVB in which an actress darkened her skin to play a witchcraft-practicing Filipina domestic worker in a TV show called Barako Karma, 1968. An Instagram video showing her applying makeup on her legs while affecting a Filipino accent went viral. Filipinos and migrant workers' rights groups lashed out at the actress, calling her out for racism and questioning why TVB could not have hired a Filipina instead. Francesca Wong, who was from Calgary, apologized for her insensitivities. And in the New Zealand Herald, killer bees at Remarama. Cops pounce on President Josh Masters. Up to 300 killer bees gang members from all over New Zealand converged on a tiny community in South Auckland as gang members started arriving for their annual general meeting. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, eco-saboteur Joseph Dibby pleads guilty to Oregon arson, conspiracy, and string of environmental attacks decades ago. Federal investigators said he was part of the largest group of eco-saboteurs ever taken down by the FBI. They called themselves the Family. More than a dozen people who committed crimes in the name of the Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front, and they caused an estimated $40 million in damage from 1996 to 2005. Dibby pleaded guilty to engaging in a conspiracy to set fire to government buildings and destroy other property, driven by ideology and as part of direct actions. In King 5, Seattle CEO Dan Price charged with assault, accused of attempting to forcefully kiss woman. Price, 37, was charged with fourth-degree assault with sexual motivation, fourth-degree assault, and reckless driving in February. The CEO of Gravity Payments, a credit card processing service, gained national recognition in 2015 when he publicly announced that he would raise all of his employees' salaries to $70,000 while cutting his own. In the Times Colonist, potential case of avian flu in Cowichan Valley chicken flock under investigation. The Ministry of Agriculture sent out notices to farms within a 12-kilometer radius after identifying a farm as a premises of concern. Island commercial poultry farms have been on alert since the Enderby outbreak was reported April 13th, with biosecurity measures that include restricted access in barns and spraying down all vehicles coming and going. The Salt Spring Island Poultry Club has rescheduled its April 30th poultry show to late May or June. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. And it don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people who give their time to organize and oversee charity, spiritual, sport, arts, cultural, and environmental groups across BC, because it's Nonprofit Board Volunteers Day in BC, so salute to Nonprofit Board Volunteers. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 24th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 24th of April in 1916, Irish rebels James Connolly and Patrick Pearse led the Easter Rising to overthrow British rule in Dublin? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.